You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. Now, this episode is all about sustainability, and this word is in danger of becoming a mantra, overused and undervalued. So today, I'm really excited to talk to Fabrice de Klerk, Science Director at EAT, or EAT, an organisation set up to transform the global food system. Now, before I go into any questions, I think it would be great if you could explain to me what EAT is and what it does.
Sure. So EAT is a rather young organization. We were started 6 years ago by Gunhild Stordahl and Johan Rockström. Many of you may know Johan from his work on planetary boundaries. Gunhild and her husband managed Nordic Choice Hotels. And Gunhild really had what she thought was a simple question to Johan. How can Nordic Choice actively contribute to improving health and sustainability? And that conversation quickly became an annual forum on food and the critical role that food plays in both human health, environmental sustainability, and social equity. And really the underlying principle behind EAT is recognizing that we have a major challenge in terms of improving public health, improving environmental sustainability, and improving social equity, and that food really is at the center of all of that. So the forum was created to create a space where the private sector, scientists, academia, civil society, and policymakers could meet and have the conversations that we often aren't having because we're in our own silos around those three domains. So really, our goal is to try to catalyze fairly radical changes in food systems for health, environment, and equity, and to do so by being a bit impatient, being a bit nudgy and disruptive, and really encouraging all of us who are responsible in change to meet together, have conversations together, and more importantly, take actions together.
And EAT isn't a bunch of nice fluffy hippies in a room sharing some quinoa, is it? It's a very science-led organization.
We're absolutely science-led, and so all of our research is what we call synthesis research, but we very much believe in the peer review process, which is what scientists do. They write a study, they submit it to blind reviewers, and often there's several rounds of back and forth before the work is published in what we call peer-reviewed journals. And so we're very much about peer review, very much about science-led, and very much about providing the best evidence to guide decisions towards, again, those three objectives.
So the EAT Lancet Commission report was published earlier this year, and you were looking at the question, can we feed a future population of 10 billion people a healthy diet within planetary boundaries? Can you give me a very brief précis of the report?
Yeah, sure. So the report had four major objectives. The first one, can we define a universal healthy diet? So what is it that we could eat or should eat that allows us to reduce mortality by food, people not having enough food, and people suffering from diseases of overconsumption or overconsumption of unhealthy foods? Number two, can we produce food within environmental limits? And there the question was, what are the environmental limits that define sustainability? Those were the two, I think, most important questions set by the commission. Number three was, well, is this even possible, or is this wishful, magical thinking? And here we can talk about this later, but the answer is it's absolutely possible to provide a healthy diet for everyone within environmental limits. And the fourth question was, well, what are the major actions that we could take or should take that allow us to bring foods within healthy and sustainable? That's the four major questions that the Lancet Commission tried to answer.
And so what are the answers?
All right, you want the answers?
Yeah, why the heck not?
So healthy diet. Healthy diet is one that's both quantity and quality. So globally, in terms of quantity, we're talking about 2,500 calories per day. And here we realized that, of course, there's going to be some variation around that, depending on how active you are, your age, whether you're male or female, et cetera. But roughly, we want to make sure that everyone has access to 2,500 calories per day. Significantly under-consuming is where we get issues of people who don't have enough food to eat. And there are still 2 billion people globally who don't have access to key micronutrients. There still are 155 million children who are stunted, 52 million children who are wasted. And that's a permanent condition, as well as recognizing that significantly over-consuming, over 2,500, has huge health consequences. And here we're seeing a growing number of people who are struggling with diseases related to overconsumption. 2 billion adults are overweight or obese. In Mexico, it's 40% of the population that is obese, not just overweight, but obese. And here again, 41 million children who are suffering with weight control, 41 children overweight globally. So quantity is important. And then the second part is quality. And this is really the composition or what foods we're eating. So when we imagine a plate in front of us, we recommend about 50% of that plate in fruits and vegetables, nuts. We recommend about 30% of your plate covered in grains, whole grains, preferably. And this sure can be rice, maize, wheat, but also quinoa, teff, all sorts, sorghum, millet. There's this diversity of grains that we can be increasing in our diets. And then it's a much more moderate consumption of animal-based proteins. And here's where I think a lot of folks felt the Lancet diet was a bit challenging. But if we go to a weekly basis, we're talking about 0 to 200 grams of beef, lamb, or pork, 0 to 420 grams per week of chicken or other poultry, 0 to 175 grams of eggs, and 0 to 700 grams of fish. And what that really flags is that you can be vegan, you can be vegetarian and be healthy, but you can also eat up to 1.5 kilograms of animal protein per week and also be healthy. So it's very much a flexible or flexitarian diet that gives people ample choice into what to eat, but also recognizes that if we're over consuming meat, for example, it likely means that we're under consuming those foods which are protective: fruits, nuts, vegetables, legumes, beans, which are high in fiber, high in protein, high in all sorts of other protective phytochemicals. So that's basically the diet. For sugar, 0 to 30 grams per week, focus on plant-based oils. A lot of people have questions about dairy. Here we recommend 0 to 500 grams of dairy per day. That's still quite a bit of dairy per day. But that's what we see it as being a healthy diet. Again, emphasis on diversity, on choice, on flexibility. For most of us living in the Western world, it's an important reduction in meat consumption. But universally across the world, it's an important increase in fruits, nuts, vegetables, whole grains.
And with the amount of dairy and meat that you see within that healthy diet, is the global food system going to have to change significantly to supply that amount to 10 billion people in the future, or is it a case of redistribution?
A bit of both, right? So when we look at animal proteins, there's a significant opportunity for redistribution. What we're seeing is that the overconsumption is happening in Australia, Western Europe, Southern Latin America, high-income North America. East Asia is also quite high, as is tropical Latin America. The rest of the world is at recommended levels. What we then see is that sugar is almost universally overconsumed. So I think an important need to significantly reduce sugar consumption. This is primarily through sugar-sweetened beverages, which are a major culprit in the fight against obesity. What we're seeing more importantly, though, so globally, we're not seeing a need to increase production of meat between now and 2050, an opportunity to redistribute. We are seeing an important need to increase fruit production by 75% between now and 2050.
Sorry, was that food or fruit?
Fruit production. Right. Fruits and vegetables, both about 50 to 75% increase by 2050.
That's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 150% for nuts and seeds. So almonds, pistachios, walnuts, all those fruits, all those nuts and seeds really significantly to ramp up. And then the crops that we've paid the most important attention to in terms of improved production technology, corn or maize, wheat and rice, we don't see any need to increase those, but rather transition towards whole grains. And that's, you know, my background's in agriculture. That came as quite a surprise to me when I first began to work with this. So those grains, we need to shift feeding them to livestock, to feeding them to humans, and to shift towards whole grains, but no important increases in food production, in grain production. But as you noted, a rather dramatic increase in fruits, vegetables, and nuts needed between now and 2050.
So how are we going to achieve these changes? Does it need to be a top-down governmental policy to try and shift the way that we eat, which obviously is anathema to people in the West and the US? Or does it need to be a shift in perception from the consumer? Or is this about changing the way that business, the food business works?
Yeah, I think all of the above, right? So I think people need to become much more used to what we call systems thinking, and much less accustomed to linear or straight line thinking, and recognizing that, you know, we really are at a critical stage in human development where the pressures that the food system is playing on the environment, that the pressures the food system is playing on public health, will not have any silver bullet solutions, and rather that silver bullet solutions are probably the next big problem that we're going to have to tackle. And that what we need to be much better at is thinking systemically. So yeah, I think that there's going to be a critical need for public policy that supports transitions towards healthy diets. A lot of work with cities that Pete is doing to try to improve food environments. That's the environment. You know, you and I walk through a store, walk through a city. What is the availability and accessibility of healthy foods and of desirable healthy foods? We have to want it, right? So there is, I think, an important need for chefs, for restaurants, for retailers to make healthy and sustainable foods the desirable, the attractive choice. There's a role for cities to make it the available, the accessible choice. There's a need for consumers to become much more educated in terms of what are appropriate quantities and qualities of food. And there's a need for the medical community to become much better trained in preventative medicine and to work with patients before they get through the hospital door. And that is changes in lifestyle, activity levels, what we're eating, how we're eating, when we're eating. All of those in combination, I think, are the kinds of interventions that we think are needed and that we see coming in terms of shifting food environments and, I think, shifting consumer behavior around what foods they're eating.
In the UK, we have a growing vegan and vegetarian movement. I'm not sure if it's a fad. I think it's more than a fad. I think people are beginning to change the way they eat, not just for cost reasons or for, you know, the choosing things that are thrown at them by marketing, but because of moral considerations. And there's almost a new way that people choose to eat. But is it enough? Because at the moment, I think we've got about 600,000 vegans in the UK. It's a start to change our sort of meat obsessed and sugar obsessed diets. But how do you push people into a different mindset on a global scale?
Yeah, it's pushing and pulling, isn't it? So in the UK, we see a lot of attention being paid to vegan and vegetarian. We see some of that in the US. I live in France, and I don't see any of it in France. Though we have seen a 12% reduction in meat consumption in France over the past 10 years, here it's been people shifting towards lower quantities of meat or lower frequency of consumption without adopting a vegetarian or vegan label. So what we're really urging people is that if you want to be vegan or vegetarian, that's a fantastic option, but you can also have equally fantastic options that come from reduced meat consumption in the West. So what we are really trying to push here again is flexibility of choice and trying to understand what's driving people to change. So we talked about the dietary guidelines of the Atlantic Commission, which does give vegan and vegetarian as an option, but it does flag that if you choose to be vegan, be careful about consuming sufficient vitamin B12 and iron. But we've talked less about the environmental or the ethical drivers, which were partially covered by the Lancet, which is what we're seeing driving a lot of the vegan and vegetarian conversation. So maybe I can take a minute to talk a bit about the environmental, the second chapter of the Lancet Commission, and how that relates to some of the food choices that people are making.
So the shift that needs to be interesting that you're in France, because the French farmers are renowned for being very strong and to be able to sway public opinion very very strongly as well. Now, if you're changing the way that a farmer farms or change their land use, that's going to cause a huge amount of conflict. The food industry is constantly in conflict with governments, and the balance between them is very tricky. To shift that takes a huge amount of work. That's a monumental effort, isn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly a monumental effort. And we're not going to be able to do this if we pit rural communities against environmental or health movements. And so it's very much about working closely with farming communities in this transition. And there's two transitions that we see, and one that I suspect is harder than the other. But the first one is a transition in how we produce food. And so here, recognizing that we're asking farmers to produce more food, to produce better food, but also to produce food in a way that converts agriculture from the first source of environmental degradation to our best bet environmental restoration. And what we mean by that is, depending on how we produce food, whether we till our soil or don't till our soil, whether we apply agrochemicals or don't apply agrochemicals, or the frequency of application of agrochemicals, how much habitat we leave in field margins, along rivers or adjacent farms, all of those are ways that farmers can store carbon in soils, store carbon in forests, keep habitat for biodiversity, movement for biodiversity across landscapes, keep nitrogen phosphorus out of water, intercept it before it runs into waterways. Those are all the challenges the farming community really has to live up to. So as a society, we're asking farmers, again, produce more food, produce better food, produce environmental services. And I think that we just need to be realistic that if we're going to put these kinds of demands on the farming community, we're going to have to reward them or recognize that they're providing not just food, but they're providing food plus these services. So here again, there's some big debates about whether food should be affordable, whereas farmers' livelihoods should be profitable. And that's, I think, a question about how do we work with the private sector to make sure that they increasingly demand or ask for foods that are produced within environmental limits, that they pay fair wages to farming communities, and what are the kinds of public policies that we put in place that are either sticks in terms of penalizing pollution, polluter pays principles, and carrots in terms of recognizing or paying farmers for public goods. And so here I think there's a question about public funds for public goods. Should we shift agricultural subsidies from paying for crops which are harmful overproduced, sugar, meat, to paying farmers for storing carbon in soils, for improving water quality, for creating habitat for biodiversity. I think this combination of ensuring fair wages for the foods they produce and are purchased by the private sector, and supplementing that with public goods, public funds to pay for the public goods, is a critical step in reaching out to the farming community and recognizing their efforts.
So just to boil that down into the simplest possible form, do you see a world where sugar production is taxed, but whole grain production is subsidized?
Yeah, so that's certainly one model where sugar production is taxed and whole grains are subsidized, and then that the agricultural practices, irrespective of the crop, if they store carbon, improve water quality, and create habitat, that farmers are paid for those public goods.
Which happens to some extent already.
Yeah, although not completely. A significant proportion, a huge proportion of public funds go simply to pay for crop production, irrespective of the practice used. But in Europe, with common agricultural policy, there certainly is a tendency to move to rewarding those environmental services. But I think more should be done to recognize those goods.
So just back to the report itself, what were the key recommendations that you came to?
So the key recommendations that we came to are one, that we need critical shifts in dietary consumption, so what foods we're eating, and that is for Europe, a reduction in meat consumption, but significant increase in plant consumption. And that if we're able to make the shift towards healthy diets, we could avert 11 million premature deaths per year. Second, an important shift in how we produce food, here agroecological intensification. So practices that allow us to maintain productivity, but to do it without putting nitrogen, phosphorus in water, without emitting more carbon dioxide from soil tillage, methane from livestock, that this is an important piece of being within the carbon, water quality, water quantity limits. And third, an important reduction in food waste and loss. And that is both in terms of food that is overconsumed. So currently in Europe and the US, we consume 3,800 calories per day compared to the 2,500 recommended. That's more than 1,000 calories per day per person that are wasted, consumed, that don't need to be consumed. Imagine the land savings if we were able to reduce that consumption, as well as the food that either doesn't make it off of the field or gets lost in our kitchens. Those are three levers, if pulled globally, allow us to feed 10 billion people by 2050 healthy diets, dramatically reduce healthcare costs and the impact of dietary health on public health, and to do that within environmental limits. That's 5 gigatons of carbon dioxide per year, zero land expansion, keeping at least 30% water flows in our rivers and streams, and keeping nitrogen phosphorus loads in rivers and streams below an environmentally harmful level. Those in combination also contribute to protecting biodiversity, which many of you may know is faced with, you know, the sixth global extinction in the history of the planet, but the first one that's driven by another species, the human species. So food, if we can flip those three levers, becomes or shifts from the main source of public health, poor public health, environmental degradation, to the first line of defense in improving public health and restoring the environment.
It's a dream scenario, isn't it? I mean, do you think this is really possible?
Well, that's probably the most surprising part of it, is that we estimate that all this is possible without new technologies. Actually, we have the technologies that would allow us to do that. But what we need to be able to do is to shift consumer behavior, which, yes, is quite challenging. And we also need to shift policies and practices that enable farmers to behave within environmental limits. So it's completely biophysically possible. But the big question that you're hinting at, well, is it politically or socially desirable? That's really the big question that we're asking ourselves. How do we mobilize both individual consumers, private sector, and policies to rally around these goals?
What did you find most surprising from the report?
I think for me, what was most surprising is, I spent most of my time working in agriculture, and we've always heard that biodiversity conservation, so environmental security, and food security are incompatible. These are trade-offs. That's one or the other. And what we found is that that's absolutely not the case at all. That we are able to produce enough food and more food for 10 billion without further land conversion. And so we've tended to approach this food challenge as a major biophysical or technological challenge. And as I just said earlier, that's not at all the case. It's a political and societal challenge. And so that's been quite surprising, because we keep running after new technologies, new tools, new methods, whereas the biggest levers of change are really, again, individual choice, private sector behavior, and the policy environment that allows us to operate within health and sustainability.
Change is a difficult thing for a lot of people to manage. Change brings about social chaos. It brings about conflict. It puts people at odds with the traditional systems within which they work in. If you look at the Inuit, when they sort of change from chasing mammals and using their usual skills to sustain themselves, society begins to fall apart a little bit, because the old skills that used to bind the society together are no longer so relevant. How do we come about this enormous societal change, but still hang together, still be integrated, still have cultures intact?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one of the first reflections is that we're constantly changing. I mean, if our grandparents hardly recognize the society that we live in, and now, even now, as a parent, looking back, the environment my kids are growing up in is completely different than the one that I grew up in. And change certainly has been accelerating quite rapidly. In many ways, when we talk about dietary shifts, we're talking about going back a bit to the kind of foods that we were eating 50 years ago, although there's huge changes in how we produce those. But what we really want to flag is that where we're seeing enormous change that is in multiple environmental variables. And here we're seeing exponential change across not just carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and how it drives climate change, but we're seeing exponential change in terms of the amount of fresh water that's available per capita. I think, over the past 2 years, we've seen multiple cities declaring water emergencies, whether it's Sao Paulo, whether it's Cape Town, whether it's Chennai, cities that were literally running out of water because of overextraction of water. We're seeing exponential change in the amount of forest that's being lost on a day-to-day basis, and a number of species that are being lost with that. The number of dead zones that we're seeing in our coastal areas because of nitrogen and phosphorus contaminating these areas, there were zero in 1960. There are now 600 every year of these dead zones in our coastal areas. This is really the exponential change that we're seeing in the environment. And we need to radically bend the curves on not just climate, but on biodiversity, on water quality, on water quantity. And so the change that we're asking in terms of how we produce food, what foods we eat, where we source those foods from, are all key drivers of bending those curves, of bringing us back within a safe environmental system. So the change that we're asking, and I know that people might find this hard on an individual level, but the change that we're asking is fundamentally the change that's needed for our own survival, for our own health, but also for the environmental health that defines the safe space that we live in. So change, yes, is difficult. With food, though, we have several opportunities. The change that we're asking people to make is driven by individual health. So the dietary recommendation that we make in the Lancet wasn't driven by a radical environmental agenda, although we do recognize a need for radical environmental change. It was simply driven by what is healthy foods, what is healthy eating. So for our own individual health, to maintain ourselves healthy, fit, active, long living, this is a change that we need to make for selfish reasons. But the simple choice of what we eat three times a day, the healthy choice of what we eat three times a day, is also a critical determinant of environmental health. And what's, I think, quite powerful about food is that that choice remains tasty, remains interesting, remains healthy. Yes, it's less sugar, salt, fat, and for many of us, it's less meat, but it doesn't mean deprivation or a lack of diversity. There's 30 to 60,000 plant species that we can explore, taste, enjoy that are part of a healthy diet. But unlike other changes like buying an electric car, putting solar panels on our roofs, which are quite expensive and out of reach for everyone, the choice of what we eat on a daily basis is one that doesn't cost us more. That doesn't mean deprivation, but one which all of us, irrespective of our social status or our economic capacities, can engage in. And I think that that's quite empowering in terms of helping us all to feel active participants in that change.
And I guess the dangers of not changing are higher and more and have greater impact than the dangers of changing. Or we hope it's that way around.
The dangers of not changing are visible to all of us. I mean, just walk around the streets of any major city and note the number of people who are suffering or struggling from weight control. And on the environmental side, I think the evidence of rapid environmental change, whether it's Bahamas, which remains devastated by the last hurricane, the fires in my native California, British farmers who struggled through last summer's droughts, these unfortunately are becoming more and more common and really do require urgent action.
So what impact have you seen from the Eat Lancet Commission report? What are the ripples that you've created?
Well, it's, you know, I've been working as a scientist for over two decades now and, you know, written a lot of papers, but I've never seen any projects gain so much attention and have so much impact. We've taken the show on the road through five continents, presented at the African Union, in Colombia, in Mexico, Costa Rica, in the US. And I'm seeing that, one, it's empowering a lot of individuals to change. We've seen youth in Indonesia, Mexico, and Africa really resonate with it. We've seen a lot of those same people say, well, I have indigenous or traditional foods from my country, which really fall within those guidelines. It's an opportunity to celebrate those foods and to really remember their cultural value, but as well as to be encouraged by their health and environmental values. I've also seen the Lancet gain a lot of media attention, a lot of debate, and a lot of it has been good debate about what those limits are and how far can we push ourselves to fulfill these diets? How can we encourage or work with farmers to produce within these limits? And then I've seen some really fantastic taking up of the recommendation by policymakers, as well as by researchers who are working with policy. The Nordic Council of Ministers is trying to develop a pathway towards healthy and sustainable foods. The European Commission has a Foresight for Food project, which is using the Eat Lancet recommendation as a foundation paper. New Zealand is testing whether it can set food policy against Lancet guidelines. I work for the Consult Group for International Agriculture Research, which does research all across the Global South, Africa, Latin America, Asia. And we're seeing our research programs being reoriented from a strict focus on productivity to one that recognizes the need to produce more, produce better, and to produce within environmental limits. So I think a lot of major global organizations from the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Health Organization, are all, I think, reviewing their own internal missions, UNICEF, and asking how do they participate in providing healthy food within environmental limits. And I think that's been quite encouraging.
So what about the future? What's next for the EAT Forum? What's next for you? And what's next for the impact of the Lancet report?
Yeah, so for impact, one, EAT continues to be present and available to support policymakers, the C-level. We work with the private sector in supporting transitions as well. And here, I think, recognizing that we've set out a major challenge, that we want to encourage public sector, private sector, civil society to all adopt this challenge, to push themselves on this challenge and remain available to help any organization or group that wants to partake. But, and at the same time, you know, we're looking ahead to the next steps. What are some of the gaps from our analysis? And we're now launching three new studies that helps to take that next step. One is a blue foods assessment, which asks, how can aquatic foods, shellfish, algae, fish from freshwater systems, marine systems, aquaculture systems, or wildcat systems contribute to healthy foods? How do we produce that food without wrecking marine or aquatic environments? That's one project with Stanford and the Stockholm Resilience Center taking the lead on the research piece. The second is recognizing that the economic system isn't fit for purpose in terms of healthy and sustainable food systems. And so we are launching with Potsdam University and Systemique in London, a food economics commission, which really is going to ask, well, what is the political economy of the health and sustainable food systems? How do we create financial systems, financial leverages that allow us to have health and sustainability as major objectives? Can we understand what the cost of action and the cost of inaction in transitioning to sustainable food systems would be? And how do we create financial systems that are aligned with and on par with those objectives? And the third one that we're doing along with the Waterland Ecosystems Program of the CGIAR is on rural transformation. And this one is really asking, what are the production practices, the agriculture production practices, that allow us to shift agriculture from the main source of degradation to our best bet for restoration? And again, how do we enable farming communities, large or small, conventional or organic, to participate in achieving those challenges? Those are the three main gaps that we've highlighted as really needing to be addressed if we're going to support this transition towards health and sustainable food systems.
So, Fabrice, the big question I've got for you, and it's very much for you rather than for EAT, are you optimistic?
I'm definitely optimistic by nature. I think that this is completely possible. Not only that, but it's completely necessary. And so I think that, you know, we need to really tackle this head on. It's really all hands on deck type movement. I'm buoyed by the youth movements that I see reacting globally, the Extinction Rebellion, the Climate for Fridays action. But I am heavily concerned that our policies and our policymakers are working much, much, much too slowly. Whether it's the absence of real leadership in the United States towards climate, to our environment, Brexit, for whatever people feel about Brexit itself, it's 3 years where rather than focusing on what I think are critical issues, we've been focusing on our relationship with the EU. These are important topics, but they're distractions against what really needs to be changed that we see over the next 2 to 5 years. We need to bend the curves on climate, on biodiversity, on water. And we're just not giving enough attention to these emergencies. I become optimistic again when I see the private sector beginning to react and when I begin to see civil society really engaging in this debate. But that's something which we need to do much more rapidly, much more urgently.
Yeah, the big change ahead. But I agree with you. I think it could be really exciting. And we don't have a choice. We have to change.
We don't have a choice, and I'm trying to travel much less by plane. But one of the places where I've noticed quite a bit of change in food environments has been in airports. in terms of what food is being offered, X-Key or other companies which are putting salads or sandwiches or much healthier fast food options for it that are very tasty. I think it's quite encouraging. What I see when I walk in many downtown areas of major cities is also a pretty important change in what's being made available. I see food companies in France embracing messaging around healthy foods, whether it's organic or, you know, the butcher shop in my village has a sign that focuses eat less meat but higher quality. So it's becoming much more part of the day-to-day conversation. And I think that that is an encouraging sign that change is coming, hopefully fast enough.
Brilliant. Fabrice de Klerk, thank you so much for joining us here on Table Talk. I'm my fingers are crossed. I'm optimistic for you. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.